This is tape two, Listen on Two Levels, Your Patterns of Negotiating. In this part, Len describes five basic needs that motivate all of our behavior. He points out how important it is to listen on two levels, the topic level and the meaning level. Len will then lead you through a reflective exercise that will help you gain insight into your typical patterns of behavior as you go about negotiating with others.
Let's talk about five basic needs that I think motivate everything we do as human beings from birth until death. What's important about these needs is that I think that they are the real topic of all of our negotiations. Whatever it is that we are talking about with another person, we're talking about that topic with the other person because it means something to each of us. What it means to each of us, I believe, has to do with these five needs. The five needs are survival, or safety. Secondly, worth value. Thirdly, competence. Fourthly, belonging. And fifthly, meaning or purpose. So let's talk about each of these. The first is our need for survival or safety. This is obviously most true for us when we are very young, when we're literally helpless and dependent on others for our survival, both emotionally and biologically. And there are other times in our life where we in fact are really threatened, where it's a life or death situation. And as we get older or when we're sick, as we have fewer options or become more helpless, survival and safety becomes more of an issue for us. But this issue becomes manifested in many ways in our life. It becomes manifested financially. It sometimes becomes manifested in whether or not we get something when we believe we have to have it. It has to do sometimes with feeling abandoned or left by others. Be aware that oftentimes something may not seem like a life or death or a safety issue to you, but it may seem like a life or death situation to someone else. So what somebody else wants from you by noon on Thursday may not be important to you at all. It may just be an annoyance or a blip in what you're trying to get done in your own work or your own life. But to that other person, depending upon the demands or stress or pressures that they're feeling, it may feel like a life or death situation to them. It may feel like all or nothing. I've been in lots of negotiations, for example, in the sale of a family business where whether or not the sale took place or whether or not it took place right now really wasn't a life or death situation, but it felt that way to the owner because of the pressures he was feeling for taking care of other family members, because of beliefs he had that he wasn't going to get to do what he really wanted to do in his life. So sometimes there really are life and death, all or nothing, real safety issues that we encounter in our negotiations with others. And frequently, we find ourselves in negotiations with others in which it seems like life or death to them. In either case, I need to appreciate that. I need to recognize that. I need to realize that when other people are feeling that stressed, that they're not listening to me, that their capacity for being cooperative and collaborative, for taking me in, for doing what I need, is very constricted. Some time ago, one of my sons, when he was a senior in high school, approached me about using my car to take his girlfriend to the senior prom. And the fact is, it really didn't make any difference to me because I was going to be at home or going to bed, or I certainly wasn't going to be out running around in my car all night. But if you could have seen his response in the kitchen, it clearly was a life or death situation to him, whether or not he got that car. In another negotiation I dealt with recently with a company that had a new president coming in, and there were senior managers who had been there for a long time and who were vested in stock, who were anxious about what this new president was going to mean in terms of both their job security as well as what it was going to mean in terms of the value of their stock. And if you would have been able to observe their angry attacks or their silent avoidances and withdrawals, it was clear that they were feeling highly threatened, that it felt like a safety issue to them, that what we had to negotiate there was not professional, educated men and women in their 50s and 60s. What we had was a lot of what looked like preschool behavior of people attacking, demanding, or going away and being quiet. So we need to be aware of safety issues as they come up in our negotiations with others. The second area of need is our need for worth and value. And I think this is really at the core of everything we do every day, and I think is definitely a part of every negotiations we do with another person. Worth and value has to do fundamentally with the degree to which I believe I have a right to be alive. And given the fact that I'm alive, what rights do I believe I have? I observe other people a lot. I observe how they walk into a room. I observe whether they seem to own their space, like they have a right to be here, or do they tend to sort of slide in with the shadows, wanting to be invisible, to have nobody notice them. Recently, I was sitting in the cafeteria of a client organization and watched four men go through the line and then approach a table with their trays. And the first man, instead of putting his tray down or making himself comfortable, stood back and waited for the second man to sort of take charge. And this man did. He went up, he put his tray down, he pulled the table out, he rearranged the chairs, he sat himself down, he directed other people where to sit. And I couldn't hear the actual conversation, but I could hear the tone of their voices as they talked, and I could observe their body reactions. And this first man who had hesitated, who had stepped back, what I observed was that he never initiated any conversation. And whenever somebody did address some comment to him, he would look down, he would clear his voice, or he had a nervous laugh. And he would normally not look at the person he was talking to. Whereas the second man, who had arranged the space to work for him, he was in effect leading the conversation. And from the little snippets that I picked up, they weren't talking about business. They were talking about their personal lives and about sports, and they were having a social conversation. It was clear that these two human beings had different beliefs about their worth and value. They had different beliefs about their rights in this particular group, and it caused them to perform, to act very differently, and to get different results from the other people with whom they're interacting. I think this is true of us all the time. I think our beliefs about what we're worth has a great deal to do with how we approach other people and the kind of results we get from other people. I think at any given time we have a price tag on our forehead. Sometimes we feel that we're worth a dollar. Other times we believe or feel that we're only worth 50 cents, and sometimes we're only worth a nickel. And guess what? Other people always know precisely what we believe we're worth, and they rarely give us more than we ask for. What you get, I think, by and large, is determined by the price tag that you put out there, not by what other people are willing to give. So worth and value comes up in other ways in us. I invite you to be aware of what it is that you look at in others. What is it that you observe about others? What do you notice about them? What is it that you comment about to yourself or to others? Do you notice whether they're men or women? Do you observe how they're dressed, their weight, their height, how their hairstyle is? Is it important to you what color their skin is, or what kind of education they have, or what they drive, or where they live, or what clubs they belong to, or where their kids go to school, or who their friends are? Is it important to you what their religious orientation is, or what their titles are? What is it that you notice about other people? What is it that you use to value other people? If you think about the other people in your family, or if you think about the other people that surrounds you at work, who is it that you respect the most, and who do you respect the least? Who are you willing to give the most time to, and who do you give the least time to? I believe that what you observe and notice about others, I believe that what it is that you respect in others, says something about what you use to value yourself, what you use to value yourself in relation to others. And I think it has a lot to do with how you approach others and the kind of results that you get from others. The backside of that, the other side of that is also true, that if other people cannot leave my presence feeling respected and valued and listened to, if a person leaves me feeling less worthwhile than when they entered my presence, then I don't have their commitment. I don't have a real agreement with them. They of necessity must go off and reestablish their own value in themselves, oftentimes at my expense. So this issue of worth and value is absolutely critical in every negotiation we have with another person. I've recently been working with two members of a family business. I work with those a lot. And one is the son of a founder and the other is a son-in-law. And they've been at odds with each other over titles and over salaries and over who's going to have what responsibilities in the business. And as we explored those issues, what became clear is that titles and responsibilities and salaries really were not the core issues at all. They were the symptoms. They were the symbols that got talked about. They were the topics that got talked about. But the real issue was the fact that neither of them felt respected by each other. Neither of them felt like the other person gave them credit or was willing to listen to them or to value the contribution that they had made and were making to the company. And once they were able to begin to have some insight and empathy into each other, once they were able to, in fact, really begin respecting each other and communicating that in ways that they experienced that from each other, the other problems became non-problems. They got solved in a matter of minutes. I see that constantly in every negotiation I'm in. The third area of need is our need for competence. We not only need to feel safe, and we not only need to feel valued, we also need to feel like we're enough. We need to feel like we're tall enough to reach the things we need to reach, that we're smart enough to figure out the things that we need to figure out. We need to believe that we're strong enough to protect ourselves in ways that we need to protect ourselves, that we have the endurance to do what we need to do in our lives. We need to know that we're enough. Much of our childhood, obviously, sets us up to form beliefs that we're not enough because, in fact, we are smaller than a lot of other people around us, and we have fewer rights. And other people aren't always sensitive to the fact that children are whole human beings. They're not partial human beings. So much of our childhood experience teaches us that we're not enough. And it seems that we spend a lot of our adult lives trying to prove to ourselves and to others that we are enough, that we're enough to do what we need to do as human beings, as professionals, as parents, as lovers, as friends, that we're enough. It seems to me that oftentimes we approach other people from the assumption that we need to get advantage over them, that we need to prove to them that we know enough or that we have the answers or that we can do it, that we approach other people in ways that put them at disadvantages, that disempower them, that make them feel less competent. I believe that is almost never, and perhaps never, to our advantage. That what is to our advantage is to help other people feel more competent, to help them feel like they have more power, to help them create more options for how they can go about getting what they need, and especially options how they can go about getting what they need in a way that allows us to get what we need at the same time. If I'm going to back another person in the corner, if I'm going to have some leverage, if I'm going to have something to hold over their heads, then they of necessity, again, must protect themselves from me. They must defend themselves from me. They can't focus on listening to me and being creative, finding options that will meet both of our needs. It is not to my advantage to disempower other people. It is not to my advantage to beat them. It is not to my advantage to strip other people, because again, they're going to have to go away from me and try to find some way to reestablish their competence, their power, their options in the world, oftentimes at my expense. And this issue of competence goes back to the issue of worth and value. I believe that most of us have most of the technical skills to do whatever it is that we're trying to do in the world. That what limits us most often is not what we in fact are really competent, capable of doing. What limits us is in what we believe we can do. When I believe that I can, or when I believe that I cannot, I'm right. Because I rarely exceed those boundaries. I rarely exceed those expectations. It's my acceptance of myself. It's the trust I have in myself that even though I get scared, even though I've made a lot of mistakes, even though there are a lot of things I don't know how to do, even though there are things that I regret, even though there are things that I am embarrassed about and just soon other people didn't know about, even though there are a lot of things that I don't do well or haven't done well in life, what's also true is that I have always found some way to take the next step, or I wouldn't be here today. So whatever it is I need to do today or this week or this month, I have a long history that says I can trust myself. I have a long history that says I will figure out some way to do that. I have a long history that says I am competent and that I deserve to give myself the benefit of the doubt, to believe that I can do what I need to do when I need to do it. My beliefs about myself are primarily what empower me and disempower me. Other people don't take my power away. I take my power away whenever I don't believe in myself, whenever I don't accept myself as being enough in my limitedness. It's the power of chosen vulnerability. It's the power that comes from being honest with myself, from giving myself a home, by giving myself a break, by making it easy for myself. Rather than saying, God, this is going to be difficult. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. What I need to be saying to myself is, so what's the worst thing that could happen? And then what would I do? And then what would I do? Because usually the worst thing isn't all that bad. It's being able to trust myself in the moment, to be able to figure out what I need to do. You always have. There's no reason you can't do it now. The fourth area of need is our need for relationships. It's our need for belonging. While I find myself in the world on my own, while there are many things that I need to do by myself and must do by myself and prefer to do by myself, there are also a whole host of things that I cannot do by myself. That the fact is we find ourselves in the world with others, and there are things that we need other people for. We find ourselves in this journey with other people trying to do what they need to do along with us. And in the course of that, what we find is that we need homes. We need to know who we can count on. We need to know where we can go to get our hugs. We need to know where we can go and rest and heal when we need that. We need to know who will provide us comfort, who will listen to us, who will affirm and validate us. We need to see ourselves reflected in the eyes of others as being valuable and worthwhile and acceptable and lovable. We need others. We need to belong. We need to not feel outside or different or odd or left out. We need to feel like we're a part of. We need to feel normal. We need to be connected with others. As I think about the important values in my life, when I think about what really makes a difference, when I think about what I'm going to reflect on and evaluate myself on at the end of my life, I think it's primarily three things. I think it has to do with what I've been able to accomplish. It's been important to me to make a contribution to make the world better and to make the lives of other people somehow better. So What I've been able to do in the world is an important value. A second value is not just what I've been able to accomplish, but how I've been able to do it. I need to not feel like I need to hide or be embarrassed or feel guilty. I need to feel like I've had integrity and how I've gone about doing what I've needed to do. And I think the third critical value for me clearly is the quality of relationships that I've been able to establish and maintain throughout my life. I believe that our relationships essentially make the difference in the degree of satisfaction and success that we have in life, both personally and professionally. It doesn't matter so much what I can do on my own. What matters is what I can get done with others. And that's what all of our negotiations have to do with, is how do we get done what we need to do with others. I believe that our effectiveness as a negotiator is in direct proportion to the quality of relationships that we establish and maintain with others. And the fifth area of need is our need for meaning and purpose. Things need to make sense to us. As human beings, we are consciously reflective. We have third-person perspective. We think about our own thinking. We only do what makes sense to us. And that's a very important concept. We oftentimes judge others because they're doing something different than what we would do, or they're doing it in a different way, or we see them doing things that are not constructive or even destructive, and we judge that. What I need to realize is that I never do anything. I'm going to say this as a double negative. I never do anything that doesn't make sense to me. I only do what makes sense to me. If you think about it, the extreme case is the person who does a suicide attempt. If that person saw a better option, they would clearly do something else. But they are making the suicide attempt because they see that as the most loving and productive thing they could do for themselves in the moment. So for all the lesser consequential things that people do around you, for all the things that people irritate you about, either in how they drive in traffic or what they do at work or what they do in your family, for all those things that seem stupid or silly or ridiculous to you, we need to remind ourselves that it makes sense to them or they'd be doing something else. And what's important about that is that if I want their cooperation, if I want them to do what I need for them to be doing, then I need to find some way to make it easy for them to understand me. I need to make sense to them. I need to not expect them to read my mind. I need to give them my data, to tell them what I'm thinking, to let them know how it impacts me, to be clear about what I need. I need to make sense to them if I want their cooperation. We need congruency. We need predictability. We need visions for the future. If I can't create a vision for the future with another person, if I can't help them imagine the possibility of how else we might do this together, then they are obviously going to continue doing it the way they've done it before. Creating meaning is essential in our negotiations with others. So I believe that these five needs, survival or safety, worth value, belonging, competency, and meaning, I think these are at the core of all of our negotiations. I think our negotiations always take place on two levels. On the topic level, which is the price or the schedule or the performance or the criteria, whatever that issue is that we talk about, the salary, the title. But what we're really talking about is what that topic means to each of us, what it means to each of us in terms of meeting these basic needs. If you'll learn to listen on both levels, if you'll learn to listen to what it means to the other person, then you'll become very effective in your interactions and negotiations with others, because it's what it means that our negotiations are really about. I invite you to turn again to the application exercise in your handbook, and in this case it's worksheet number 3, and it says your patterns of negotiation worksheet, and there are a series of columns there that I invite you to fill out. The first column, I ask you to identify some examples, and you might want to identify both examples where you are not getting the results that you want with others or have gotten stuck, or unresolved, and maybe an example or two where you have gotten the results you wanted from others. And then in the second column, mark behaviors. In each of those situations, what is it that you do behaviorally? What do you typically do? Do you attack, name call, blame, avoid, wheedle, whine, complain to others, gossip, try to logically convince them, make them guilty and obligated, rescue them, take care of them, deny there's any conflict, placate, apologize? Do you get tough and independent? Do you dismiss them, act superior? Do you explode and get angry? Do you go do it yourself? Do you listen? What is it that you do in each of these situations? And it's not fair to say all the above. You got to make choices. So what do you typically do in each of these situations? And then in the third column, what's the dialogue that goes on inside of you? What do you say to yourself, about the other person, and about what's possible in each of these situations? And in the fourth column, marked fears, what is it that you worry about? What are you afraid might happen? Or what are you afraid won't happen in each of these situations? And in the next column, marked needs, what is it that you need in each of these situations? What are the outcomes that you desire? What are your objectives? And what is it that the other person needs? Be aware that what you need is different from what you want the other person to do. What you want them to do is in response to meeting your needs. And then in the next column, marked results, in each of these situations, what kind of results have you gotten or are you getting up to now? And finally, in the final column, think about what kind of commitment there is. What kind of commitment is there in each of these situations on your part to, in fact, understand the other person and to really have resolution? What's really going on in the wishbone in your chest, in your heart? Do you want to understand, or in these situations, do you want to be right? And what are you doing if you go back and look at your behaviors to try to be right? After you've taken the time to fill out these columns, kind of step back and look at it. What do you see as patterns? What do you see as the difference in your beliefs and your behaviors in those situations that are not working versus the situations that are? In each of those situations, what is it that you and the other party really need? And have you talked about that explicitly? Have you made it easy for the other person to understand what you need? Have you made them feel valued? Have you made them feel safe? Do they leave you feeling competent? Do they feel connected to you and valued? Do you make sense to them? Or have you not effectively responded to each other's needs? My guess is as you look at your examples, you'll find that what you're doing in relation to each other's needs is at the core of understanding the kind of results that you're getting.
This is the end of tape 2.